Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, second hour of Open Forum, and we hit the trifecta today. I don't know how you hit the trifecta and there's only two people involved, but it feels like hitting the trifecta when you get Tim Staples first hour, Jimmy Akin second hour. We are at the pinnacle here. Jimmy Akin is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, the author of A Daily Defense, 365 Days Plus One to Becoming a Better Apologist, and the author of the brand new book. Well, I say brand new book. That's not the right way to say it. The about to be brand new book, Teaching with Authority. Hi, Jimmy. Oh, I'm sorry, Jimmy.
Hi, Si.
How are you
taking
a sip? I beg your pardon. I am very, very well. Thanks for coming in for us this afternoon.
Yeah, my pleasure.
There's a ton of people, so I'm probably going to move right to
expeditiously.
Expeditiously, yes. Thank you. And I just need to remind people what Open Forum is. Open Forum means if you have a question about the Catholic faith, it's welcome. You're welcome to call if you're Catholic. You're welcome to call if you're not Catholic. You're welcome to call if you agree with us. If you disagree with us, it's all welcome. And you, generally when Jimmy's here, we also encourage if you have a question of a more general religious nature or philosophical, moral nature, those are welcome as well. The number is 888-318-7884. Let's go to Christine in Maryland, listening to EWTN on Sirius XM satellite channel 130. Christine, your question for Jimmy.
Hi, good evening, good afternoon. On Sunday, our homilist was talking about the sexual scandals within the church. And one of the remedies that he advocated for was the end of the vows of celibacy for diocesan priests. And my question, I've been doing research about the topic. And my question is in reference to St. Paul, and it seems that in First Corinthians, he calls for celibacy of clergy, but in 1 Timothy, he talks about, it seems like he's talking about married priesthood. And so my question is he contradicting himself? And then if you have any other comments about celibate priests, I would welcome any additional comments.
Okay, so I'm not sure where you see him calling for a celibate priesthood in 1 Corinthians. He has a general call for celibacy in 1 Corinthians, where he argues that if somebody is unmarried, that it's better, especially given the circumstances that obtained in the first century, when there was, as he put it, the world was passing away in its present form. There was a lot of a storm and stress, and things were very uncertain, and they knew they were going to be going through a cataclysm, which indeed they did. And he said that it's better for someone who's single to remain as they are so they can devote themselves wholeheartedly to the Lord rather than having divided interests. Because if you're married, you not only have to have concern for the Lord, you also have to have concern for your spouse and your children and so forth. And so he had a general appreciation for celibacy that he recommended to people broadly, but he also recognized that there was a role for marriage. And he said, this isn't everybody's gift. It's better to marry than to burn with passion. So if you have a particularly amorous nature and you really need to get married to deal with that, then do so. He also acknowledged that various, except for him and Barnabas, most of the other apostles were married. He mentions Peter was married. He mentions the brethren of the Lord were married, and some of them apparently traveled with their wives. So he didn't insist on celibacy for ministers in particular in the Corinthian epistles, as far as I'm aware. He does get more in that direction when he's writing to Timothy, where he tells Timothy to fulfill his commission as an evangelist and to be, in essence, a good soldier for Christ. And he talks about how a soldier does not get entangled in civilian affairs but makes his aim pleasing his superior officer. And he's not explicit about what he means by civilian affairs, but given Paul's known views about seeking to please the Lord first and not getting married— that's a very plausible construction of what he's talking about when he's talking to Timothy. So I would say that he is consistent in both groups of letters, where he has a high value for celibacy but does not insist on it as something that must be. Having said that, throughout the course of history, the church has seen great value in having most of its ministers be celibate, at least in the Latin church. And it's not a teaching of the church that it has to be that way, so that could change. In terms of would it effectively address recent sexual abuse problems? Well, not for the most part. Recent sexual abuse problems have involved primarily, and this is like 80%, primarily homosexual relations and also relations with underage people and with seminarians. And under no circumstances would married priests be allowed to have homosexual relations either or relations with underage people or relations with seminarians. I could see if there was a big sexual scandal involving priests and adult women that saying, well, maybe we need to reevaluate this celibacy requirement so we let more priests marry adult women and have that as an outlet for their natural desires. Well, that would make some sense. But saying let's have priests marry adult women when the issue is 80% homosexual and involving underage people, I don't see how marrying adult women is going to address that.
Christine, we'll leave it there. Thank you very, very much. I hope that was helpful to you. We go now to Aaron in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Also listening to EWTN on Sirius XM satellite radio. Aaron, your question for Jimmy.
Hi, Jimmy. My girlfriend and I like to go to Latin Mass whenever we can.
Mm-hmm.
And this past Sunday, we accidentally went to a Latin Mass church. We were traveling. We went to a church that turned out not to be in communion with Rome.
Mm-hmm.
This church was run by the Congregation of Mary Immaculate Queen, and it was only after we walked in the door that we realized that they are a set of conscience group.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I already knew I needed to be careful to make sure the churches we go to aren't FSDX, but I wasn't familiar with any other groups that aren't in union with Rome that call themselves Catholic and offer the Mass and all the sacraments in the extraordinary form. Now, from what I've read the last couple of days, the CMRIs do have validly ordained priests, but obviously they don't have faculty. So my question is, what is the status of this group's sacraments, and how does their status and the status of similar set of conscious groups compare to the status of FSDX?
Okay. I don't know that I would say one needs to absolutely steer away from Society of St. Pius X chapels, because even though they're not in a fully regular situation with the church, the excommunications for schism have been lifted from their leadership, and they've been given faculties to, for example, hear confessions. And so even though they're not in a fully regular situation, I wouldn't have the same kind of must stay away approach to them. In terms of any seat of a contest group, though, for people who are listening who may not be aware, seat of a contest are people who think that the current pope and recent popes are not valid popes, so that there is no current valid pope, or at least the one that the Catholic Church holds to be the pope is not the pope. They may have elected their own. Like there's an anti-pope who lives in Kansas, for example, who is just elected, however, but is not really a pope. All such groups are in a state of schism, and consequently, they are to be absolutely avoided. So I would say do not go to seat of a contest groups. It's something that you want to stay away from, and so that would be my basic answer.
And we will leave that there too. Aaron, thank you very, very much for that call. I really appreciated, Jimmy, how you clarified that the anti-pope living in Kansas is not the real pope.
I'm glad
we're
in fact, no anti-pope is the real pope. That's why they're anti-popes.
Yeah, that comes with the job, is you're not the real pope if you're the anti-pope. Demons, Deliverance, and Discernment, that ebook that we've been giving away free, we're still giving it away free. So if you want it, go to the Catholic Answers Live Facebook page. That's the place to go, our Facebook page. Just go to the Facebook page, type in Catholic Answers. It'll come up, and you can get that free ebook, Demons, Deliverance, and Discernment, right now.
Your number one source for Catholic apologetics and evangelization, Catholic Answers Live.
You've heard that St. Paul Street Evangelization supports hundreds of teams of evangelists sharing the good news. But did you know that some of these teams are public prayer stations? Set up a sign on the sidewalk and offer prayer and encouragement to those you encounter. Everyone needs prayer. Try this new method of witnessing to Jesus. Contact St. Paul Street Evangelization to get started at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
The leading Catholic voices are on EWTN Radio.
I enjoy hosting Open Line Tuesday because of the variety of questions that our listeners call in with. The show also gives me the opportunity to personally connect with Catholics and non-Catholics all over the world, telling me as host what their cares and concerns are in the areas of faith, family, and fellowship.
Open Line with Father Wade Menezes, tonight, 10 Eastern, on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, Open Forum. Jimmy Akin, our guest this hour. Lots of folks on the line. And as Jimmy says, moving expeditiously through the calls, we go now to Catherine, listening on Cause of Our Joy Radio in Pittsburgh, Kansas. Pittsburgh, Kansas doesn't come with an H. Catherine, your question for Jimmy.
I was wondering if Mary only had Jesus as her only son. Why do they refer to him as her firstborn son?
This is because the firstborn had a special role in Jewish culture. Even if there were no other offspring, the first one, especially the first male offspring, had a special role. And this was true not just of human children, but of any offspring. There was a principle in Judaism before the time of Christ that the first bit of something belonged to God and was consecrated to God and was special in as a result. So for example, if you planted a field of, say, wheat and then you harvested the wheat, the first bit of that wheat you harvested became known as the first fruits, and you had to offer that to God as a way of indicating everything comes from God. And so to signify that, the first bit that we get is something that's holy to God, and we're going to give it back to him in acknowledgement that everything ultimately comes from him. They did the same thing with animals. So if you, say, had a cow and the cow gives birth, well, the first of her offspring is consecrated to God. The cow's firstborn is holy, and so you offer it back to God. You don't keep it for yourself. And then there was the question of, okay, this principle, if everything comes from God and we thank God by giving him the first bit back, what do we do in the case of humans? Because if a woman has children, whether it's one child or many children, that principle is going to apply here too. The first child is holy to God, especially the first male child in Judaism was holy to God in a special way. But since you can't sacrifice a human, instead what the Israelites were instructed to do was redeem their firstborn sons. To redeem something means to buy it back. And so even though you could sacrifice the first fruits of your grains and you could sacrifice the firstborn of a cow, you cannot sacrifice the firstborn of a human. And so in that case, to acknowledge the fact that it's holy to God in a special way, you buy it back from God by paying a price to the priest. And this is what we see – this is one of the customs we see Joseph and Mary observing in the beginning of Luke's gospel. It's also talked about in the Old Testament, where this law is set forth in terms of what you need to do with your firstborn sons. And obviously, when you have your firstborn son, you don't wait to see, oh, are there going to be any other children before you do this? You do this immediately. And so as a result, firstborn sons had a special status in Israel, even if the parents never had any other children. They still had a special role, and so they were still called firstborn, even though there were no other children. And that's what's happening here with Mary. Jesus is Mary's firstborn because he's also her only born. But because he was the firstborn child she had, he has this special role under the Jewish law, and so they redeemed him the way they were supposed to, and he continued to be known as a firstborn because that's what he was, even though Mary had no other children.
Catherine, that sound all right?
Yes, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your call. Appreciate it. We go now to Jim in Indianapolis, listening on the EWTN live stream. Jim, thanks for your call. Your question for Jimmy. Nope, no Jim? All right, hang on. We'll come back. We'll see if Jim's there in a second. Let's try Eric in Connecticut, listening on iHeartRadio. Eric, your question for Jimmy.
Hello?
Hi, Eric. Do you have a question for Jimmy Akin?
Yes. I actually converted to Catholicism 3 years ago. I used to be a Congregationalist Protestant. And nothing was really a problem right up until recently when I discovered I'm actually a direct descendant from the Mayflower. And this raised a bunch of questions to me about my Protestant roots. So I was curious if you could recommend to me some books, you know, from a Catholic point of view, that's what I really want, on basically what happened. You know, I'd like some answers.
Well, so until you said from a Catholic point of view, I was going to – most people are after kind of neutral, you know, discussions. And I was going to recommend The Story of Civilization by Will Durant. And he's a non-Catholic historian that has some volumes dealing with the Reformation and the Counter-Reformation. There are – also books from a Catholic point of view that deal with church history. For example, James Hitchcock is a Catholic historian who's written about church history. So has William Carroll, C-A-R-R-O-L-L. And if you go to – if you go online and look for James Hitchcock at Ignatius Press, you'll find his one-volume work on church history. If you go to Amazon and type in William Carroll, you'll find his multi-volume history of Christendom, and he's got material dealing with the Protestant Reformation. There are others that are more specifically focused on the Reformation. A lot of them are ones I haven't read, so I can't really recommend them in the same way. I don't have as much knowledge of them. We publish some here at Catholic Answers. You can go to Catholic.com and type in, you know, Reformation and see what comes up. There are also some that were written about, you know, around 100 years ago that are coming from a Catholic point of view, some of them like by, for example, Hilaire Belloc, who was a British Catholic writer. And they contain useful information, but they're also written from a kind of highly polemical point of view, which was common in that day because there were – the polemical situation between Catholics and Protestants was very tense in England. You had a lot of Protestants who were really bitterly anti-Catholic, and you had Catholics who were trying to deal with that situation, and they were kind of polemical in return. And so personally, that kind of highly polemical stuff is not to my taste. I like more neutral, less defensive, less offensive treatments of periods in history. So you may want to be aware of that as you look at some of this literature.
My whole family, both immediate and extended, is Protestant. Everybody, and it's not that I'm getting shaky in my Catholic faith. It's actually the total opposite. I just like to be able to come across to my Protestant family and be able to witness in a way that they'll be able to understand that, you know, this is Catholicism, it's the true church.
Yeah, and for a lot of that, actually, you may not want history in particular. You may want apologetics because what the truth of the Catholic faith is doesn't really depend on, you know, how this other non-Catholic group arose and how it split off from the church or how it split off from another Protestant church. Really, I mean, if you're wanting to document the truth of the Catholic faith, you want books of Catholic apologetics. And for that, I would recommend something like my book, A Daily Defense, which has, you know, 365 different defenses of various points of the faith.
Eric, thank you very, very much. I hope that was helpful to you. It is open forum today on Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest this hour. Jimmy is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. If you have a question about the Catholic faith, whether you are Catholic or not, you're welcome to call 888-318-7884. That's 888-31-TRUTH if you prefer the spelled version. We go now to Jim in Boston, Massachusetts, listening to EWTN on Sirius Satellite Radio. Jim, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hi, Jimmy.
Howdy.
Hello?
Hello, you're on the air. What's your question?
Oh, so first of all, thank you. I've been listening to you guys for a few years, and it's really deepened my walk as a Catholic.
Thank you.
Participating better in the sacrament. It's overwhelming how much difference it's made, so thank you. I just wanted to say that.
It's our honor to have played a role.
I was praying the rosary in the presence of the Blessed Sacrament last Friday, and I had an insight staring at the cross that it must have been just a continuous second-by-second act of will for Jesus to stay on the cross, to even go through the entire Passion. And I was comparing that to how often, you know, I'll get hung up about just making myself do something that's a little bit hard, right? And I was just wondering if that tracks with Catholic theology, because I'm just getting started on that. I'm not very deep in it.
So I'm not entirely clear on your question. Is your question, did Jesus will at every moment he was on the cross to continue the experience?
Well, yeah, that is the question. I was thinking, you know, at any moment he could have changed his mind and 1,000 angels would have rushed in, knocked over all the Romans and Jews, and he could have walked away.
In principle, although then he wouldn't have been fulfilling the will of the Father, because it was the Father's will that he do this. And his divine will was completely in submission to the Father's will. And so as a positive act of his divine will, he definitely willed at every moment during the crucifixion to experience that. In terms of his human will, he fundamentally willed to go through this experience. That doesn't mean he didn't have emotions that would move in one direction or another as he experienced various things. We see that kind of emotional tension in him in the Garden of Gethsemane, and it would have then continued throughout the Passion as he experienced progressively more difficult things. He's like any human. Jesus, in his human nature, was death averse, which is what we see him experiencing at the Garden of Gethsemane, aversion to death and suffering. He also was pain-averse, like we all are. He had a nervous system with pain receptors, and all of us experience an aversion to pain. And so there's going to be a natural emotional reaction to the experience of suffering and death on his part, but fundamentally still on the human level, he willed to embrace this and to experience it.
Jim?
Thank you very, very much.
All right.
Sure thing.
Jim, thank you very much for calling. Again, open forum today on Catholic Answers Live. You are welcome to call 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. Jimmy, we have a question that a person left, wanted to ask it off the air from Spirit Catholic Radio, an anonymous person. I married my wife in a Protestant church. Can I still receive communion? If not, what can we do so that I can receive communion again?
Unfortunately, the facts here aren't. I need another fact, which was, did you get a permission from your bishop to marry outside the Catholic Church? If you did, then you're fine. The marriage is going to be valid. It's not a problem. If you didn't, then yeah, there is a problem. But what you need to do is see about having your marriage convalidated, or in common colloquial words, having your marriage blessed. And this is something that happens all the time. Just contact your local parish, say, here's what happened, and they can guide you about, do you need a convalidation, or in other words, do you need to have your marriage blessed? And they can help you work through the process from that point.
Anonymous, thank you for that question. If you have a question for Jimmy Akin, you are welcome to call 888-31-TRUTH. It's open forum today on Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy is the author of many things, but I haven't asked you about the book. Well, just how close we are to Teaching with Authority. We'll talk about that when we come back, and maybe a little bit about Jimmy Akin's mysterious world, the freakiest post this week on the Doomsday Machine. We'll be right back with Jimmy after this.
Catholic Answers Live.
A generation ago, Christian parents didn't have to worry about how to explain transgenderism to their 9-year-old children or help their teenager deal with mockery at school for believing in traditional marriage. But today, as our culture decays, we have to know how to talk to our children about these issues. In Made This Way, How to Prepare Kids to Face Today's Tough Moral Issues, Layla Miller and Trent Horn give parents the crucial tools and techniques to form children with the understanding they need, appropriate to their age and maturity level, to meet the world's challenges. If we're not teaching our children how to understand tough moral issues, then the world will. Read Made This Way and learn how to give your kids a firm foundation on which to build a life of moral clarity and happiness. Order your copy of Made This Way today by calling 1-888-291-8000 or logging onto the shop at Catholic.com.
For Catholics, history matters. Ours is not a religion based on mythical events. Ours is a religion based on recorded history, in which God has revealed to humanity something about himself and his church through the person of Jesus Christ. In his new book, Handed Down, The Catholic Faith of the Early Christians, author James L. Papandrea offers a fascinating window into the life of the early church and demonstrates that the early Christians were decisively Catholic in how they acted and what they believed. Handed Down is perfect for history-conscious Protestants looking for a friendly defense of Catholic belief, as well as for Catholics who want to deepen their connection with our forefathers in the faith. Order your copy of Handed Down today by calling 1-888-291-8000, going to Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Tomorrow is Halloween.
There's no more important time to fortify ourselves against spiritual dangers with our guest, Adam Bly.
Tomorrow on Take Two with Jerry and Debbie.
Now let's return to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest this hour. I am Cy Kellett, your host, and okay, when I talk about the podcast, Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, you did one on the Doomsday Machine.
The secret Soviet Doomsday Machine, yeah.
Perimeter. Perimeter, mm-hmm. Yeah. And so you can get that where?
You can go to jimmyakin.com or sqpn.com or YouTube, or just Google Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, and that and the other episodes that have come out so far will come up.
And the book, the Teaching with Authority, we're within a few days.
Within 2 weeks is my understanding. I don't know if we're going to have it in-house in 2 weeks or if it's shipping in 2 weeks, but it's 2 weeks.
And you can order it now and it's at the discount, which is the great thing. You get the fall discount as well if you just put in the promo code CALIVE18 when you buy it at shop.catholic.com. And then as soon as we got it, you got it.
So did you listen to the Soviet Doomsday Machine episode yet?
Part of it.
Part of it?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And not,
scary?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Really, actually, you don't – I guess you just don't think about how – precarious the whole situation. I mean, you don't on a daily basis reflect on, wow,
yeah,
we really are in a position to do ourselves damage if I was going to say if somebody decides to let off the nuclear weapons. But in this case, nobody would even have to decide.
Well, after a certain point, it would all happen automatically.
Yeah.
So for people who may not be aware, Perimeter is a semi-automatic Soviet doomsday weapon system that actually got built and actually still exists, but it's not turned on most of the time. They would turn it on during a crisis, and then if they suffered a nuclear attack, Perimeter would trigger a counterattack.
Right.
But that's one of many interesting subjects. Coming up this next month, we have cloning the Lost Tribes of Israel and the JFK assassination.
Really?
And the fall of Jerusalem and its role in prophecy.
This is fun for you, isn't it, Jimmy?
Yeah, it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, this is your kind of thing. That's very cool. Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World is the thing to look for. Teresa in Pennsylvania is next. Also listening to EWTN on Sirius XM Satellite Radio Channel 130. Teresa, your question for Jimmy.
Yes, hi. I have a nephew that just got engaged to his fiance, who is another man. Mm. So they're getting married, and also there's grandchildren involved, and they're 4 and 8, mm-hmm. two little boys, and we're all very close, and I have a feeling that they're going to ask one of them to be the ring bearer.
Ooh.
This is going to be the first wedding that they've been to,
mm-hmm.
and it's going to be a gay wedding.
Uh-huh.
How do I deal with this?
Well, so what's your relationship to the children? What are you in the family with respect to them?
The grandmother.
You're their grandmother. Okay. So you could obviously talk to their parents and share your concerns with them, and you know, especially, I mean, this would be true anyway, but especially in the case of a first marriage they're going to, this is not going to present them with a clear vision of what marriage is. And so simply saying, I'm sorry, but our kids are going to have to decline and we're not going to take them is certainly what many parents would choose to do in this situation. You could certainly encourage their parents to do it. Also, we have a book that we've just published by Layla Miller and Trent Horn called Made This Way that is specifically designed to help people talk with children about issues like this and how to navigate some of those waters. So I would suggest getting a copy of Made This Way by Layla Miller and Trent Horn.
Thanks, Teresa. Thanks for that question. Made This Way is out now from Layla Miller and Trent Horn. Hope you will get it. Hope that was helpful to you. So let's go to Cindy in Missouri, listening on 94.3 FM. Cindy, your question for Jimmy.
Hello.
Hi, Cindy. You got a question for Jimmy Akin?
Hi. Yeah, I do. I am a Catholic. I've always been a Catholic, but I'm hearing the word Jehovah or Jehovah is God's name. Could you help me out with that?
Well, so Jehovah is an English representation of God's name, but it's not what he actually would have been called by the ancient Hebrews. And by the way, for more information on this, I have an article on this that's going to be coming out in the January-February issue of Catholic Answers magazine that talks about in detail about all the stuff I'm about to mention. Originally, the Hebrew writing system did not have vowels. It only had consonants. And so when the Hebrew Bible would – back in the day, when the Hebrew Bible would refer to God's name, it would spell it just using the consonants. And the consonants were the equivalents of the English letters Y, H, W, and H. And these four letters, YHWH, are often known, therefore, as the tetragrammaton. That's a Greek term that means the four letters because there's four of them. And because the Hebrew Bible didn't originally have vowels in it, there's some uncertainty about exactly how this name would have been pronounced. And based on a variety of lines of evidence, scholars have concluded that the most likely way that it was pronounced by most people most of the time would have been Yahweh. Or, you know, you might change the inflection a little bit, but basically it would have been Yahweh. The way we get Jehovah is connected with a practice that arose in the centuries just before Jesus's time. You know how one of the Ten Commandments says, don't misuse God's name, you know, don't take his name in vain? Well, some in the Jewish community thought, you know, maybe the best way to avoid misusing his name is not to use it at all. Mm-hmm. And so at a certain point, it became taboo to say Yahweh. And they therefore needed, you know, let's say they're in synagogue, they're reading from the Old Testament, it's got God's name right there. What are you going to say instead? Well, you could say any number of things, but one of the common things that they chose was a word that means my Lord, the word Adonai. And so so they began to say Adonai wherever the text said Yahweh. And then over the course of time, they started to invent vowels for the Hebrew writing system. These took the form of little points that you would put above or below or within the consonants, little marks. And so there came to be a question when the scribes started putting vowels in the Hebrew Bible, what vowels were they going to put in? Were they going to put in the vowels for Yahweh? Well, maybe, although by this point they weren't necessarily 100% sure if those were the right vowels. But what they decided to do instead was to take the vowels for Adonai, A-O-Ah, and put them in Y-H-W-H, or the Hebrew equivalents of those letters. And that way, it would serve as a reminder to the lector in the synagogue to say Adonai instead of Yahweh. Mm-hmm. And even if he made a mistake and just read the word as it was written in front of him, the result would not come out as Yahweh. And so so that's how they put the vowel points for Adonai, A-O-Ah, into Y-H-W-H. Well, then a Franciscan in the Middle Ages named Petrus, I forget his last name, but a Franciscan named Peter came along and said, ooh, here we have Y-H-W-H with the vowels A-O-Ah. We would pronounce this in Latin as Yahowah. And that got anglicized as Jehovah. And so Jehovah is an anglicization or an English version of the consonants of the divine name plus the vowels of the word Adonai. It's not what they would have called God back in the Old Testament, and so it's not God's name as it would have been understood by ancient Jewish people. If you said, praise Jehovah, they wouldn't know what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
It's an English representation that's kind of a variant on God's name.
Cindy, what do you think of that?
Yeah, wow.
Yeah, wow. No, you're pronouncing it wrong. I'm just kidding.
It should be Jawow.
Jawow. Yeah, I am so glad you asked the question, Cindy, because I have to say I've never heard a full explanation of where – I knew that Jehovah was an anglicization of something, but I never heard the full deal. Yeah. Cindy, thanks for the question.
Oh, thank you.
We'll take a break, but I was mentioning Jimmy's book and that you can get it on sale. Don't forget, the fall sale continues at shop.catholic.com, 20% off hundreds of items in the online store, but you got to use the promo code CALIVE18, shop.catholic.com, CALIVE18.
Like they do many other Marian dogmas, Protestants reject Mary as the Mother of God because they don't think it's scriptural. But if there's any Marian dogma that's biblical, it's Mary, the Mother of God. Consider Luke 1:43, where Elizabeth greets Mary as the Mother of my Lord. As any Bible student knows, Lord is the title that the Jews used for Yahweh. But Protestants object that Lord can also be used for an earthly ruler. Although this is true, I think the parallel that Luke makes with David's cry in 2 Samuel 6:9, "How can the ark of the Lord come to me?" suggests the divine usage. Just as David speaks of the ark of God, Elizabeth speaks of the mother of God. So, does the Bible teach Mary as the mother of God? You bet it does. I'm Carlo Broussard with a ready reason for Catholic Answers, Catholic.com.
You know what Catholic radio is? It's training for the troops. It's a interaural of the ear boot camp. The folks who listen, who grow in their faith, grow in charity, grow in all the virtues, they then go out and exert an influence far beyond just themselves. Catholic radio has an exponential effect for bringing people deeper into the faith.
Dr. Ray Guarendi thinks Catholic radio is important. So should you.
Welcome back to Open Forum on Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest. Lots of phones to get to, moving with alacrity through them. We start with Joe in Portland, Oregon,
with
watching
clearness.
Alacrity?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, we don't want to
move through them with unclearness. Yeah.
Well, yeah, with a lot of chitter, chit-chat. I almost said chitter-chatter. Mm-hmm. Joe in Portland, Oregon, watching on YouTube Live. Thanks for watching on YouTube Live, Joe. Your question for Jimmy.
Hey, Jimmy. So I'm an atheist, and I was a former Catholic for a considerable amount of time in my earlier life. And I eventually left the church after coming to the conclusion that I was challenged by an atheist friend who said, you know, what are your reasons for being Catholic? And I came to the conclusion that I only believed it because it's how I had been raised. And I came to the conclusion that I didn't really have any good reasons to believe in Catholicism or even more broader Christianity or even religion or the supernatural in general. Okay. And so I just sort of abandoned all that. Nonetheless, and it's not like it's not like I necessarily feel like I am missing something without religion, but there definitely is something nice about being part of that sort of religious community, as I'm sure you know. And I'd like to maybe just give it another shot and make sure that I was very thorough in investigating the reasons for why I left, I guess, and saying, so I guess my question for you then is, what is the most compelling evidence for you personally that makes you believe in, yes, this whole Christianity deal and, yes, the whole truth of the Catholic Church and all that?
So I tend to personally be – and there are different ways of approaching this question that are going to work for different people. What works for me is the standard kind of triple argument or three-prong argument that we have good evidence that God exists. We have good evidence that Jesus rose from the dead, which then validates his role in God's plan. And then we have good evidence that Jesus founded the Catholic Church and intended it to be his church throughout the ages. And then based on those three conclusions, I would mount various arguments. In terms of the first one, that God exists, there are a bunch of arguments for God's existence, but I tend to favor a version of what's sometimes called the contingency argument. Basically, it's an application of the principle of sufficient reason, that for anything that exists, for anything that is, there must be a sufficient reason for that. And so I look at the universe and I say, well, why is the universe the way it is? And you could talk about, well, it evolved to its present state from a previous state. But that's not what I'm asking. That's asking about its history. I'm asking, why is it at all? When it could, you know, what's keeping it in existence? What's making it the way it is? And you at this point might say, okay, well, there are various laws that the universe operates according to, and these laws keep it in existence and keep it in its current shape and so forth. And that's fine. I agree with that. I think there are such laws. And my question then is just kicked back a step. Why are there these laws? Ultimately, there has to be a sufficient reason for all of this. And whatever that sufficient reason is, is commonly termed God. And so I would say that we have good reason to believe that there is something that can be meaningfully called a God. Now, that doesn't tell us a lot about God. For example, it doesn't tell us that God is a person, that it's a personal God. But we can establish that based on other arguments. There's not going to be a single argument that tells you everything about God, unless you wanted to like stitch together a bunch of arguments, kind of like a computer subroutine or computer program with lots of subroutines. So then that leads me to Jesus rising from the dead. There are various alternative explanations that have been proposed. You know, maybe the disciples went to the wrong tomb. Maybe Jesus just swooned on the cross and woke up in the tomb. Maybe Jesus was a myth. So there are these alternative explanations. But when you look at the evidence and look at it carefully, the alternatives aren't as successful. They aren't as convincing as just the hypothesis that, no, he really rose from the dead. And if so, then that points to him having special knowledge of the supernatural world or what lies beyond death, what lies beyond nature. If someone says, I'm the Son of God and I'm going to be crucified and died and then rise from the dead, and then they do that, well, then that's a claim you have to take seriously, including their claims about God. Like, God's not just an abstract set of laws. God is also a personal God. So then from there, I look at, well, what did Jesus say about his church? And he only addresses it explicitly under the name church in two passages. They're both in Matthew. The more informative one, although they both have information that's helpful, the more informative one is Matthew 16, where he says to Peter, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church. So Peter, of all the disciples, has a foundational role. And he says, and the gates of Hades, from the Greek, will not prevail against it. So Hades was the place of the dead. And so if the place of the dead is not going to prevail against his church, then his church is never going to pass out of existence. So his church was in a special way founded on Peter and is going to continue through the rest of the world, so it still needs to exist today. And he says, I give you the keys to the kingdom of heaven. So he's giving Peter a special leadership role. And he says, whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven. Whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. We know from other first century Jewish sources that the power of binding and loosing referred, among other things, to the ability to create and abolish laws for the community. And so consequently, he's giving Peter, and later he shares a degree of this with other church leaders, to make and abolish laws for the Christian community. That means that his church is a visible institution with leaders and laws. And so if we look around and say, well, what church today has existed from the first century and has a visible structure with leaders and members and laws and is built in a special way on St. Peter, that's the Catholic Church. Now, there's a lot more that can be said on all that, and I'd suggest taking a look at Trent Horn's book, Why We're Catholic, and also my book, A Daily Defense, that'll go into all of this in a lot more detail. But those are kind of the broad outlines that I use when I think about, you know, the evidence for our faith.
What do you make of that, Joe?
Well, I really appreciate you sharing that with me and just kind of getting your perspective. I will say, you know, I've heard a lot of the same sort of reasoning from other Catholics, which makes sense. I mean, it makes sense that most Catholics would probably have similar reasoning. I guess in general that it's just mainly the second point, the whole you look at the evidence and it seems the most likely way to explain that evidence is that Jesus just rose from the dead. And personally, I have a problem with that because you know, I mean, we've never observed or recorded anyone rising from the dead. So the claim that somebody would actually rise from the dead, that's very extraordinary.
And so
for me personally, I feel like almost any alternative explanation would be more likely.
Mm-hmm. There's a set of books that you might want to check out by a Protestant scholar named Craig Keener, dealing with miracles. And the claim that Jesus is the only person to rise from the dead or that other miracles don't occur is not as well supported as one might think. There are other plausible claims of people rising from the dead, not in exactly the same way Jesus did, but of other people who've come back from the dead, and also – and not through technological means either. I'm not talking about people who had their hearts jump-started in a hospital after being clinically dead, and other miracles. I understand it's not part of the atheist worldview, and it's not common to see miracles. If they were, we wouldn't regard them as miracles. We'd regard them as, oh, this is that ordinary thing that happens in nature.
Yeah.
But there are there's more to the case for miracles than you may be aware of. And so just as a worldview issue, you might want to check out the books on miracles by Craig Keener.
Joe, thanks for the call.
And by the way, I appreciate the fact that Joe was able to identify a specific area of concern of his because that makes it easier to be of assistance. You know, unfortunately, we're getting near the end of the show today, but I'd encourage Joe to keep listening and call back, and I'd be happy to help more in the future.
Thanks, Joe. Let's go to Beth in Louisiana listening on WQNO. No, she's not. Just lost her.
That's unfortunate.
It was not me. Let's go to Jim in Indianapolis.
Okay.
Jim. Real quick, Jim, your question for Jimmy. Oh, please tell me that. Jim, second time, not there? Oh, he's breaking my heart, that Jim.
That's unfortunate.
All right.
It's not for lack of us trying.
No, let's try Chris in Tennessee. Chris, are you there?
Yes, thank you.
Oh, thank you, Chris. You got to be real quick, though, your question for Jimmy.
Well, I don't know if it is a quick answer, but you did touch on it with your last answer, to be quite honest. But
what's the question?
So I'm more of a traditionalist type of Catholic, and I've done a lot of reading and researching into the Orthodox faith, and so I know some of the history that goes along with
Chris,
that.
Chris, I want to be able to give you the best answer I can. How would you put this in the form of a question?
Go from the Roman Catholic to Orthodox faith.
Why is that an apostasy to go from Roman Catholic to Orthodox faith?
No. Well, it wouldn't be apostasy. Apostasy means to completely turn your back on the Christian faith and say, I'm not a Christian anymore. People who leave the Catholic Church and become Orthodox are still Christians. They're still professing Christians, so there are brothers and sisters in Christ. But because they've separated themselves in a voluntary way from the successor of Peter, they're in a state of what's known as schism. Schism is the refusal of submission to the Roman pontiff or the refusal of communion with those who are in communion with the successor of Peter. So the proper term for that is not apostasy, but schism. And it is a serious thing to do that knowingly and deliberately because, as I covered in my previous answer, Christ founded his church on Peter in a special way, and to knowingly say, I don't care that Jesus did that. I know he gave his church a special Petrine charism, and I'm going to break away from this church that Jesus founded that has this special Petrine charism. That's neglecting the will of our Lord in a serious matter, and to do that knowingly and deliberately, it can jeopardize your salvation. So that's something that one does not want to do.
Yeah, definitely.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yes, sir. That sounds great. Thank you for your time.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate you getting to that question quickly. And I don't know.
Let's try it.
Several people there, then not there today.
Yeah.
But again, I want to remind folks, Jimmy's got this pretty new, only, what is it, about 2 months old podcast?
Yeah, about 2 months.
Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. You'll really enjoy it.
It's already got like 8,000-something subscribers.
What? Mm-hmm. 8,000-something? That's a town.
Yeah, that's, small one.
That'd be a good-sized town. You could have a good high school football team in a town of 8,000.
Uh-huh.
And that's how I decide.
Okay.
Also, you could have a Subway a sandwich up there.
You could.
Which also makes it a
pretty
good
sure count. About that. Yeah.
Yeah. I measure everything by how many sandwiches are available. Jimmy Akin, thank you again.
My pleasure. Anytime, Si.
Very fine hour. We will be off now, but back to it tomorrow. If you have questions about the Catholic faith, that's what Catholic Answers is all about. Don't forget, the fall sale continues. Go to shop.catholic.com. Put in CA Live 18 and save on everything there. Thanks for the sound, Nick. Thanks for the video, Andrew. Was it Andrew or Brandon today? I can't see behind that. Thanks for the video, Brandon. And assistant producer Marie, thanks for the very fine assistant producing. I don't know what you do, but you do it great. We'll see you tomorrow, God willing, on Catholic Answers Live.